Congratulations, you have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 559 of the Lambcast. I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, from Kirkham A Movie A Day and the Strother Martin Film Project. Our new era on the Lambcast begins with a show that I hope will be more typical in the near future. We're discussing a new theatrical release. For months now, we've been limited to streaming premieres, draft shows, look-backs, and assorted film-related topics. But except for Tenet back in August, we've not really had a strictly theatrical release to talk about. As COVID peaks again in some places and theaters remain in lockdown in two of the U.S. major markets, studios continue to be reluctant to put their product in the marketplace using the interface they have relied on for 100-plus years. With budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars, the risk that your return will be insufficient in the current marketplace is certainly legitimate. Today's film, however, has some advantages in that regard. IMDb estimates that the budget for Freaky to be around $5 million, and it comes from a studio that's well known for getting maximum mileage out of their low-budget features. In its 8 days of release so far in the U.S., it's brought in nearly that much, and with international numbers, they're climbing and they're on their way to success at recouping their investment. I've managed to find four lambs who've seen Freaky and can join us for a discussion of the film and its parts. Let's meet them now. Once thought to be an urban legend who crawls out to the movie theaters every prom season, we now know that it was mostly cold weather and the Michigan lockdowns that kept him disappeared. Returning, the Michigan movie guy, Cameron Kanacki. Welcome, Cameron.
Hello.
Good to have you back with us. Next, she's always ready for a jump scare, in part because she never looks at trailers before the movie starts. One of the critical movie critics, Lisa Leahy.
Hi, Richard. How are you? Glad to be here.
I'm doing great, and I'm glad that you're here, too. I'm glad I was able to find enough people to fill the show who were able to see the movie. All right.
It was actually my return, so I'm excited.
Excellent. Excellent. I cheated a little with our next guest. I didn't go far to find her. Our third guest was not the mascot for her high school team, and she's very thankful she never had to dress up as a beaver, but she did have the requisite best friends in case she needed help battling a 6'5" serial killer. The Hollywood consumer, my daughter, Amanda Kirkham.
Hey.
Glad to have you, Amanda.
Glad to be here.
And finally, he does have an ancient Aztec ritual knife, but he only uses it to open his fan mail. A first-time guest on the Lambcast from Paul's trip to the movies, welcome Paul McGuire Grimes.
Hello, it's great to be here.
Great to have you with us, Paul. Since it is your first time on the Lambcast, we're going to ask you to tell us a little bit about yourself and your movie sites.
Well, it's great to be here. So I've been reviewing movies since about 2010, I would say. You know, I went to school to be an actor and then had that portion of my life where I wasn't getting some work. So I thought, well, I need to keep up my creative juices. And I've always been passionate about film. So I'll just start reviewing movies on a blog and kind of see where it goes. Started doing that. And then I saw an opening at a local TV show. It's called Twin Cities Live for a film critic. So I reached out to the producer of it, who I knew outside of the show, and asked him, like, hey, I'd love to do it. I've got a theater background. I know how to do live from a live audience. So I did the screen test and got on Twin Cities Live. So I've been doing that since about 2014. I'm on there every Friday. And then I also am on a local pop culture radio station called My Talk 107.1 every Friday as well. So I do TV and radio. I've got my own website, paulstriptothemovies.com, as well as a YouTube channel on top of it. So I've got a variety of mediums and platforms that I'm on. I'm a member of the Critics' Choice Association, so I vote for those awards every year, and I'm a Rotten Tomatoes approved critic.
Very nice, very nice. I also know that your lamb number is in the 1500s, but I forget exactly what it was. Do you remember?
Yeah, I've been on the site for quite a few years now, which is really great.
Yeah, very good. Yes, well, I don't know if you've listened to the Lambcast in the last couple of years. Our long-term host has kind of retired from actively hosting the show. I've been taking over for the last few months, and now the show is mine to run, as they say, and I'm going to do the best I can to keep it going, and I'm trying to keep as many people involved as possible. And that's one of the reasons that we're reaching out to people that we haven't had on the show before. We're going to try and encourage more of this. And, Paul, I'm glad to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for asking. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. So let's get to the movie discussion itself. Freaky is a mashup of Friday the 13th and Freaky Friday. In fact, I think the original title was Freaky Friday the 13th, and then they switched it a little bit. They did delay it from Halloween release, even though it's a horror film, because they really wanted, I think, that Friday the 13th release day. The premise is simple. After swapping bodies with a deranged serial killer, a young girl in high school discovers that she has less than 24 hours before the change becomes permanent, and so she has to solve that problem. Let's get to the discussion. We'll start off with our spoiler-free conversation, but down the road in the podcast, we'll probably get to spoilers. So those of you listening, listen for that warning. Lisa, let's start with you. What did you think of the premise of this movie? Does it work for you?
I got a kick out of this, I got to tell you. You know, as you mentioned in my intro, that I don't watch trailers, and frankly, I didn't know what it was until I saw it listed as, like, hey, this movie is out. And I'm like, all right, it's a horror movie. I'll go. Kind of had the little inkling, but, you know, as soon as I saw that it was, in fact, a Freaky Friday remake, I was like, okay, I can get on board with this. I enjoyed it. I mean, I think that it's not something that you're going to get. So that's something that's just going to be more than you expect it to be. You know, like, you get this petite, adorable blonde teenager, and then you get Vince Vaughn, and you go, okay, so there's going to be Vince Vaughn running around acting like a 14, 15-year-old. I kind of know where this is going. However, you know, like I said, having seen nothing before I went into it, there were definitely times when I was laughing out loud in the theater, and, you know, I anything that will do that for me is a win in my book.
Well, good, good. Amanda, I know how you felt about it, but why don't you tell other people how you felt about it?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting that Lisa doesn't look at the trailers, because that's, of course, how I first discovered it. I had heard nothing about it. I actually thought it was coming out in October. I saw the trailer on, I think, Facebook at the beginning of October, and I went, oh, yes, awesome, a horror movie in time for Halloween, and then I realized it was actually a month later. But I love the premise. I love Vince Vaughn, so I thought that the trailer was really well done in getting the idea kind of put out there, and then also convincing me that I should go see it. I quite enjoyed it. I don't think it's perfect, but I think it's a little interesting to talk about movies right now that are out in theaters, because there aren't that many, and I'm just happy to be going to the theater to see something, and so I'm wondering how much of it I enjoyed just because I was able to go see it in person, and how I would have felt differently if it were just sort of another release at normal times. But I think I think it does a pretty good job of doing the body switch story with the slasher killer story. And like I said, I think Vince Vaughn is hilarious. So I laughed quite a bit as well.
Nice. All right, Paul, you are open to express your opinion on a variety of things. We have more specific topics as we go along, but how'd you feel about the movie?
I really enjoyed it. I'm a big fan of scary movies and slasher flicks, and especially when they are kind of as meta and as riding a balance of tone really well, which I think this does so well. I was all in. Now, I did see the trailer because it was sent to me, so I probably actually would not have watched the trailer before, because I tend to not watch a lot of trailers for that very reason of not wanting things spoiled, but I sent it to me, so I was like, okay, I'm going to watch it. And I was like, oh, this looks like it has a lot of promise. And I think I knew from the opening scene that this was going to be right up my alley. It felt very aware of itself. It knew exactly what to do with the genre. It knew what it was making fun of while still keeping it to be a scary movie on top of the comedy in it. And you can just see all of the little references to Scream and The Shining and other things throughout it. I thought it was well done. And I did not see it in the theater. I did the press junket for it. So I got to interview the two of them, Vince Vaughn and Catherine Newton. So I was sent the movie to watch through Universal's Screener Passport app. So I watched it in my theater room.
Nice. So you didn't have to worry about COVID spreading around while you were sitting in the theater.
No, not in my house. Yeah, I have been to the theater once, and it was for Tenet. They did not allow us to watch that at home. Our press screening was at a local theater. There was just three of us critics, so they kept it really minimal, and it was before the theater itself had opened for the day, mm-hmm. so I felt comfortable with that space.
All right, Cameron, did you make it to a theater and see this film?
Yes, I did. Well, turns out a few days after I saw it, due to, you know, people not abiding by the rules, they would have to shut down movie theaters and all other places like that here in Michigan for the next 3 weeks, so until December 8th. Yeah, so I got to see it, not once, but twice.
So you had a narrow window in which you got a chance to see it, because they closed the theaters again, huh?
Yep.
And if you saw it twice, I'm not assuming that you did that just so you could be so thorough on our show. I assume that you probably enjoyed it.
I really did. I enjoyed it a lot. I loved the, you know, the original take on, you know, the story of, you know, switching bodies and everything. Vince Vaughn was probably his best since Wedding Crashers. And I really enjoyed Catherine Newton's performance, and I think she's going to go far in the future.
All right. Paul, are you a fan of these body switch kinds of movies? Have you seen a lot of them before?
Oh, I mean, I've seen a handful of them, and I think that there's a fine line, especially like Jumanji is a really good recent example, where I kind of felt like Jack Black as the high school girl was a little too much. Like, he kind of annoyed me in it. So I think there's a fine line to be ridden. But I thought that Vince Vaughn actually did it really well. And maybe it's because he's not trying to be... I don't know. I think that he and Catherine Newton worked really well together and pairing them well. Yeah, but I mean, I've seen Freaky Friday. I've seen a handful of them, I would assume.
All right. Amanda, have you seen most of those other body switch films?
I'm sorry. Was that directed at me?
I didn't
hear the question.
Well, I was asking everybody how they felt about the kind of the body switch films and if they'd seen these sorts of films before. Paul just mentioned Jumanji, the remake that we had just a couple of years ago, and he was talking about Jack Black maybe exaggerating the character a little bit when he was doing his body switch. I was just wondering what other things you might have seen that involved the body switch kind of plot point.
Yeah, so I've seen a few of them, and I've always kind of been interested in the pairings, and I know... I think it's interesting because typically I find that the older actor is a little bit better at the imitation of the younger actor. But I think one of them that works really well is actually the Freaky Friday remake with Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan. And I like that. I think it's interesting with this, you don't necessarily have the, like, understanding the other person, as part of the storyline in terms of, like, in Freaky Friday, they have to you know, learn about the other person and change a little bit of their mindset so that they can get back to their regular bodies. And there's a little bit of that, but it's not the emotional side. But I like the body swap movies. I think they're kind of fun, and I like the concept. And it's always funny when you have something, especially like, you know, 6'3" Vince Vaughn and tiny petite little teenage girl switching and seeing what that's gonna do. And I thought that they did a couple of interesting things with exploring that. I don't know if we want to get into that just yet, but some of the things that work when you're in a bigger body and some of the things that don't work when you're a littler body. I thought that was kind of an interesting take on this one.
All right.
Lisa, Cameron, what do you guys think about these kind of body switch films?
So they're generally not my bag. I mean, I certainly love Freaky Friday. I love Big. You know, I'm a child of the 80s, so I go to that, which isn't quite so much a switch as much as a fish out of water, you know, 12-year-old in a big body sort of thing. But I'm not a physical comedy kind of person in general. So, you know, going into this and getting the concept pretty early on, thinking, okay, I see where this is going to go. Yet, you know, some of the physical stuff did really end up working for me for this particular film. And, you know, just what Amanda's been talking about, you know, some of those discoveries, because you're not only switching body size, you're switching body gender. And so I think that's kind of interesting as well. And they played with that in a way that wasn't totally obnoxious. So I definitely appreciated that end of it.
All right, Cameron, how about you? You got an opinion on this?
Well, the only real body switch films I've seen are Freaky Friday and... Yeah, pretty much Freaky Friday.
That's it. There you go. Well, I tell you, this is an interesting concept. There are a lot of films that have been based on this. I think Lisa, you said you were a child of the 80s. There was a one-year period in the 1980s. We got three of those body switch movies back-to-back. Vice Versa, like Father Like Son, and 18 Again. And I think they all came within a few months of one another. And, of course, they were
right
all...
right after Big.
Yeah. And they're all comedies, and they're all based on the idea that, you know, there's a relationship that already pre-exists between the characters in those stories. This film, of course, it's a body switch where there is no relationship between the characters. And so it's the change up in the story is, of course, the personality of the characters. We've got this kind of nebbish teenage girl who is clearly very attractive and very bright, but she's not one of the popular kids. She's a little bit socially awkward. And then we have this hulking serial killer who basically doesn't speak at all. He's very close to being a Michael Myers type character or a Jason Voorhees sort of character when he is killing. And we get an early scene on that. We'll talk about those scenes in just a minute. So I think that I appreciated the switch in tone that the film was trying to bring up, where it's not just, well, let me see things from my mom's perspective, or let me see things from my child's perspective, but it's really a very different perspective that you're looking at. Plus, the gender switch also gives it an additional opportunity for comedy. You get some bathroom humor that goes along with it, which, you know, I don't think that was going to be a surprise. That was going to come up. But it wasn't terrible. It wasn't overdone in that regard. Cameron, did you think the movie was as funny as it wanted to be?
Oh, yes. I laughed a whole lot during it.
Oh, good. Was there anything in particular that you were amused by?
Nothing in particular, but more throughout, I guess.
All right. Paul, how about you? Did you think you said you thought it was pretty funny.
I did. I think there's the scene, you see it in the trailer too, about where you've got the two supporting friends. You know, you've got the playing into their stereotypes, if you will, where they say, oh, I'm the black guy, and I'm the gay kid, and I'm the black girl, we're going to get killed off. Like, they're well aware of the rules of surviving a horror movie, according to Scream, and they play into that, and I think that's where a lot of the humor comes into play, and they totally are great with that. That's where I think it's funny, is when it's poking its fun at the genre.
Yeah, the genre joke that I liked was the scene early on in that opening section where the Blissfield butcher basically impales a girl on the wall and then basically repeats the Michael Myers head tilt that is used in Halloween, and which was emulated several times in the subsequent Friday the 13th movies also. And I thought, okay, that's clever, that's cute. And there were a lot of little touches like that. That I thought
wrote that
good.
Down in all caps, Richard. I saw that. Oh, there's the head tilt. I'm in.
And somebody mentioned a reference, I think, to The Shining. And I'm not, I only saw the movie one time. And I'm trying to remember what scene or what character.
Yeah, that was me. I think that there's a shot. It's really quick where the camera's under the Blissfield Butcher in a way that there's a camera shot in The Shining where he's under Jack, uh-huh. who's trying to get through the door. If I remember correctly, it's been a few weeks since I've seen Freaky now, but I feel like there's that.
Yeah, when he's trying. Yes, I know what you're talking about. He's trying to Yeah, when he's trying to like bang his way through that door, and it's like his head banging against the door, and they've got the camera from the bottom up into his face.
That's right. I do remember that scene, and I, you know what? I didn't associate it with The Shining, but I did think, well, there's a clever visual element of the film. Now I know why it seems so clever, because it's cribbing from Kubrick. There we go.
Right.
Well,
there's
we could do that.
Intelligent things in this film that I really liked. Like, I going back, I realized it's rated R, and I was actually kind of surprised because, and I guess that's the language and the brutality of some of it, but this is a teenage horror movie. You know, this is not a movie aimed at people like me who have seen all of the different horror movies that have come out for the last 20 years. You know, you mentioned the jump scares, which is accurate because I don't tend to jump at jump scares anymore because I've seen so many of them. So seeing a film like this where you know all of the tropes going in, and then you've got Landon and his writing partner, Kennedy, putting together a meta film that knows what it's doing, that knows all of the different rules, knows all of the different tropes, and so it's playing to us as much as it's playing to the new teenagers who are going to be seeing this for the first time. And I think that's really smart, this idea that they're able to attract both audiences and that it's able to work for both audiences.
Well, he had some big successes with doing the same kind of thing with the previous films that he did in this genre that were mm-hmm. also movie mashups, the Happy Death Day and the Happy Death Day to You.
Which are really fun movies.
I didn't see the second one. The first one, I didn't hate it, but I wasn't as big a fan of it as a lot of people were. They really seemed to enjoy it, and of course it is a mashup of Groundhog Day with a horror film, so it worked on that level, and you could see how they're going to milk that for a lot of the humor, and it's also going to be appealing to an audience that isn't there for the slasher kill moments, but rather for the humorous bits and the teen drama that goes along with it. And I did my positive element, the positive thing that I saw about Happy Death Day was that character did grow as a result of the experience that she was having. They try mm-hmm. to do that a little bit in this film as well. I'm not sure that they're very successful about that, but I want to wait and talk about that when we get to the spoilers on the show. So we'll hold off on that a little bit. Anybody else have an opinion about the humor? What things worked well for you, or what things did you think fell flat?
I mean, I've got some, like, because I sit there with my notebook and I take notes through the whole thing because for whatever reason, I'm afraid I'm going to forget things.
Yeah.
I loved very early on the death with the tennis racket. I mean, that was an authentic laugh out loud from me sitting in the back of the theater all by myself. I mean, I thought that was hilarious, and I don't know why, because it's really not all that spectacular, but it caught me by surprise and I really enjoyed it. So, just some of the cuts and some of the deaths, I think, were just strangely entertaining for whatever reason. You know, as much as it's a slasher film like any other slasher film, they didn't do all of the same kinds of things. They did come up with a few surprises that I enjoyed.
Well, Lisa, you, I think, are in a good situation by not seeing the trailer, because they basically pimp three of the humorous kills in the trailer, and I think it diminishes our reaction to them a little bit. The cheerleader who ends up in the cryo chamber, that I knew was coming, and you know what's going to happen because they show it in the trailer, and it's so frustrating.
Right.
It would have been so much more effective if we hadn't known it was coming, and so that you probably would appreciate it more than I did. We'll talk about the gruesomeness of the film in a couple of seconds here, but the other question, of course, is it is a horror film. Did you think it was scary, anybody?
I don't
scare. I'm not a good person to ask that too.
Anymore,
go ahead.
Especially at these types of slasher flicks. So I don't know if I found it scary, but I think if you are like a young teen crowd, you would be scared with it. Like if you were coming in fresh without a lot of background, then yeah. But I didn't find it always scary.
All right. Amanda, you're not a young teen anymore, so did you find it scary?
Ouch.
Sorry.
Thanks for calling that out.
I gotta call it as I see it.
No, I didn't think it was very scary, but I've never really found the slasher films really scary. You mentioned jump scares a couple times, and I'm not a big fan of jump scares. I think that they tend to just kind of be slapped in, and there's no tension around them. And I'm a fan of the tension building horror. You know, I wanna be on the edge of my seat the entire time, and then if you put a jump scare, that'll work. But I think there were a couple of moments where they tried to kind of do that. The opening sequence is one, and then there's a sequence later that's kind of in a maze. And actually, it kind of reminded me of I used to go to the Halloween Horror Nights at Universal every year, and it reminded me of that. And it's funny because the last time I went, they had Blumhouse? I don't know how to pronounce it. But they had one that was entirely about that because it was for Happy Death Day. And so it kind of felt like I was watching one of the mazes. So I didn't think it was super scary. I thought it leaned a little bit more heavily on the humor side, and then, like you were kind of mentioning, with some of the gruesome deaths, the sort of horror aspect in that regard of the horror of the violence.
All right. Well, we'll get to the violence and the gruesome effects in just a minute. I think we'll kind of hold that on for our spoilers section, because even though it's a horror film and we know some of the people that are going to get killed, not all of them end up being killed, and some of them, of course, are killed in interesting ways. So we don't want anybody who hasn't seen the film yet to be any more spoiled than they have been by seeing the trailer.
Did I spoil one? Sorry.
No. Yeah, like I said, the trailer gives away so much, so it's hard for these things to be hidden. There's one in particular that I think I would have enjoyed a lot more had I not known it was coming, and we'll get to that in just a second. Before we get to the spoiler section, though, a couple of you have mentioned that you thought Vince Vaughn was pretty good. What do you think he managed to do to make this work? Paul, it sounds like you have been trained as an actor. What kinds of acting techniques did Vince Vaughn use that you thought made it easy for him to sell the idea that he's a teenage girl?
Well, I'll go back to I also just thought that he made for a great villain because he had that kind of lumbering, tall, like, stature and, like, walk gait to him. Mm-hmm. So he had that, like, Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees vibe to him, which I think made the personification of the Blissfield Butcher even better, because he knew the genre and what to do. And I think that the other end of the spectrum with him playing the Catherine Newton role after the swap is that he didn't just flail around a whole lot with, like, I think part of what I had issues with Jack Black is when he did that in Jumanji is that he then just came across like a little too
A parody, like, of a teenage girl.
Yeah,
maybe.
A little too 13-year-old girl-ish.
Like, too whiny 13-year-old, almost as if he was playing a stereotypical gay man. And as a gay man myself, like, I was trying to figure out how to phrase that correctly. You know, where I think Vince Vaughn didn't fall into those, like, silly tropes, silly choices, you know.
I would agree with that.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that she was bad. I thought she was quite good, especially in the first section and the section after, near the end. But Catherine Newton, when she is supposedly embodying the Blissfield Butcher, this was one of the inconsistencies in the film that I had a little bit of a problem with, because in addition to changing bodies, I think the butcher changed personalities entirely. A lot more socially adept, patient. You mentioned, Paul, that Vince Vaughn's the lumbering kind of killer at the beginning, and there's not really a lot of lumbering going on. The only thing that she does that indicates that she is this deranged killer is, you know, she glares at people very fiercely, and she picks up a knife that she doesn't use occasionally, but we're supposed to know that she's tempted to use it the whole time. And I don't think it's the actress's fault. I think the part was underwritten for that particular character.
Mm.
I would agree with that. And somehow the Blissfield Butcher is exceptional at doing her makeup.
Yes, there you go. Thank you. That was the other thing I was going to mention.
I was like, okay, sure.
The guy can't take a bath and lives in a, you know, basically a dump. But when he embodies this young girl, suddenly he's got incredible fashion sense and knows how to put on the makeup in a way that it's like one of those teen romances from the 90s where they are suddenly transformed by somebody and they walk down the stairs and everybody says, "Oh my God, who is that?" You know, and
saw that.
She wasn't wearing glasses at the beginning. I mean, yes. That was the only thing they didn't include.
Well, yes. They did get her out of the beaver costume.
Well, yeah, you know, baby steps, I guess.
Yes. So, like I said, I don't think it's the actress. I think it's the way the story's written. They want to get as much humor as they can. They want to make clear that there is a character in there, but I think they kind of changed the character a little bit to be able to make the story work the way they have it intended. Anybody else have any thoughts about this before we get to the spoilery section?
I had a quick thought about Vince Vaughn's performance. And I don't know if it was intentional or if it's just the fact that he is older. I thought it was interesting that once the switch happens, he always seemed to be running out of breath in each scene that he was. And I think the idea may be that, you know, the teenager has all the energy and you know, physical ability to do certain things, and he's an older guy now, and so, like, they did kind of do it a couple times. You know, they're running, and he's, like, being outrun by the friends or something, but I thought that was kind of an interesting thing where it's, like, she still wants to do all the things that she could do in her own body, but now she's in this giant, you know, old man's body.
And it is true, because he does do the Jason Voorhees, Michael Myers walk. You know, mm-hmm. He catches up with you no matter how fast you're going. So right. This, you know, 6'5" body is not used to running.
Yeah.
I think that fits right in as well.
Well, the chasing that happens in the opening scene is a lot more vigorous than the chasing that happens in the later part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's tell everybody who's listening, if you haven't seen the film yet and you want to avoid spoilers, this is a time to come back to our program and listen to the rest of the show after you've seen the movie, because from now on, we're going to be talking about this with any spoilers that we feel would be appropriate. So, I'm going to start with one that I think the horror folks would like. What do you think of the kills in the movie? Did you think that they were interesting, vivid, different? I had one or two that I liked quite well, but like I said, I thought they were a little bit spoiled. Amanda, let's start with you, because I know that you like this kind of stuff.
I actually thought the most effective kills were all the teenagers at the beginning, because mm-hmm. none of that was in the trailer that I saw or that I could remember. And so And I think Paul mentioned the kind of Scream call-outs. That whole opening sequence reminded me so much of the Scream opening sequences that are like kind of the fake-outs. You're following this group of teenagers, and you think, oh, they're going to be the big part of the story, and then they all die. And I thought that whole section was pretty effective. I liked the impaling of the one on the thing on the wall. The freezing one, I think that was the main one that was shown in the trailer, and so that, you know, had no impact when I saw it because I had seen it a dozen times already. The one that I thought was the most gruesome is, of course, the shop teacher. That was, if I had not known that it was an R-rated movie before, I would have done it after that.
Yeah, I think the shop teacher is the one I hate to reveal too much about myself, but that's the one that I smiled the most at during the movie.
Oh, sure.
It was plenty gruesome, and I thought they showed it pretty vividly, even though you knew it was coming a little bit. That's the one I think, had I not known that it was coming, I'd have enjoyed so much more, because it was, but I still enjoyed it. To me, it was the most interesting kill that the butcher does in the form of the teenage girl. I also kind of like the fight that they have. The shop teacher is played by Alan Ruck. So talking about callbacks, you know, he was a teenager in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and now he's the abusive shop teacher
in
this film.
Horrible.
Yeah, not a good person.
I am offended. I am a high school English teacher. I have many comments about this guy.
Yeah, well, that's not the way that somebody would talk to their students, I don't believe.
Oh, my God, I hope not.
But I was kind of surprised at how vivid the fight was that they had. I mean, he's punching her and kicking her, and he's not just pushing her away and saying, I'm going to turn you in. He is fighting.
He's taking out every last aggression he has against this girl, which, frankly, I never understood. There's nothing. She is not that snarky jock, you know, student who's always giving him a hard time. You know, she's this.
Yeah, I agree.
Timid thing who gets picked on, and he unfairly is calling her out for not being prepared for a presentation he's scheduled for her for next week. I mean, I'm going to call them out on their writing of that.
Yeah, that's
not
right.
It didn't make sense.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense to expect a student to be ready a week before their project is due is insane. And the only reason that I think it's in the movie is to make us hate him anticipate what's going to happen to him when the butcher is in her body. So it's all foreshadowing, and it's a little lazy. A little lazy. How about any of the other gruesome moments? Anybody approve or disapprove of any of them?
I think because they are so over the top and ridiculous, it just plays into the tone and the camp factor a lot more than it would have if they would have taken themselves too seriously. Like, clearly, like, the frozen, like melting or, like, smashing into pieces, so over the top, ridiculous, love it.
Well, that's Jason X too. That's a callback, you know. Yeah. Like that was in Jason in Space, you know. Yeah. Jason X.
Yeah. Oh, amazing! What an epic kill.
Absolutely.
An epic kill. Of course, the Alan Ruck one is so over the top. Those were my two favorites because of the ridiculous nature of them, playing into again the whole screen quality, the Alan Ruck, Henry Winkler type role. I think they had to kind of go that route.
Well, I thought the football players at the end also, I appreciated the gruesomeness of their deaths, but they don't really show quite as much of it. We see the after effect at one point. We see the body parts strewn around them as they're laying on the ground, and I thought that was, I don't want to sound sick, but that's the funny part of that. That's the part where we're laughing at how ridiculous this is and how over the top it is, and so I kind of appreciated that, although I think I might have enjoyed seeing a little bit more of the killing process in that situation.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel like that was almost a missed opportunity. Like, you're gonna play on the, you know, that stereotype of the jocks who are gonna do these awful things to this girl in a back room, and okay, so if you're gonna play that stereotype, at least, you know, I guess do something with it. I mean, it's almost like a missed opportunity. They could have even called back to Carrie on that one. You know, maybe set them on fire or something. I don't know. I just felt like you've got the ubiquitous giant dance scene where everything's going to go bad. And it just was kind of anticlimactic for what it could have been, I thought.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. Well, what other things in the film didn't work? We picked on a couple of things earlier. Is there anything else that people thought was problematic?
Well, I don't know that it's problematic, but since we were just talking about the kills, I do think it's interesting that everybody that dies is kind of a terrible person. So, you know, it's like the shop teacher isn't a good guy. The football players at the end are jerks. The cheerleader is kind of a jerk. And all the teenagers at the beginning are also kind of assholes. And so it just means that the kills are, I guess that's to make it a little bit more enjoyable to watch the kills. But it does mean that, like, you don't necessarily feel any kind of, I don't know, remorse, or you're kind of going, well, it's, I don't know. In some of the other slasher films, you actually are afraid for the victims. Here, it's kind of like, well, the victims are jerks themselves, so you don't necessarily care as much.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
We don't really have much sympathy for anybody who dies, and all of our sympathy is for the kids that are her friends and continue to live, and for her family members.
Yeah,
I was waiting for mom to get it, because she was that, you know, oh, the drunk mom. Now, at least they gave her a reason for it. She wasn't just a terrible person. But it was like, okay, mom drank too much. She's a passed out on the couch kind of thing. Like, you're calling Nightmare on Elm Street back with that one. But, all right, so thankfully, I guess, she doesn't die. I mean, I don't know. I think that was a real cringy scene. The scene where they're at the thrift store.
That's the scene that I thought was particularly cringy.
Holy Toledo. Between that one and the scene between Millie and Booker, when Millie is in Vince Vaughn's body in the back seat of the car, and I'm like, I see what you're doing. I understand your audience, and I still don't know if it would work for them. that was just such an – I mean, let's start with the one at the thrift store. You know, you have the mom coming to help unseen individual who says that he's trying on polos, and then she completely spills her guts about how she lost her husband a year ago, and then she out of nowhere is asking him on a date. I'm thinking, I don't care how depressed and awkward you are, this is not going to happen. It was a little much for me.
Yeah, I think – when I made a reference earlier to Happy Death Day, and it had a kind of redemptive arc to it, where the girl in the story is kind of estranged from her father, and there's a process where they come together, I got the feeling that he was repeating the same concept here so much less successfully. That it's it's, you know, an awkward premise to begin with. First of all, we have to swallow an awful lot in order to believe what's going on in the beginning of this. But the next thing we have to believe is that they're going to have a conversation like this in the dressing room of the store that she works in, through the door, never seeing each other, revealing intimacies and developing a connection. That was just really awkward, and I know what they're trying to do, because they're trying to, you know, bring these characters together at the end and be able to see them in a slightly different light, but I didn't think that worked at all.
Yeah. I actually wrote it in my notes. I'm like, I can do without the mushy dressing room scene, thank you. Verbatim what I wrote down.
The only thing that I think that scene does contribute is that it makes the mom a little bit more sympathetic. I mean, she's the whole reason that, if you can really look at it, the whole reason that the body swap happens is because she didn't pick up Millie, and she was left at the football stadium, and so you've got to have a little bit of, like, of that sympathy coming back in. But I agree, I think there's a little bit much kind of revealed, and I don't think the whole idea of asking somebody out who you haven't seen, you literally have just been talking through a door, I don't think that would happen.
I agree with you on that. I think you're right, though, this idea of giving her some kind of redemptive quality after having left her daughter at the football game, like you said. I think it's another added element to that teenage story trope where all of the adults are fools.
Yeah.
And it's up to the teenagers to figure things out in the end.
Yeah.
Right. On the other hand, I know exactly the discomfort level that they were creating with that scene with them, Booker and Vince Vaughn's character, you know, as in the backseat of that car. That's, you know, that's supposed to be humorous, and it is humorous because it is awkward. Cameron, what did you think of that? Did you respond to it, or were you uncomfortable, so uncomfortable that it wasn't funny?
No, I laughed at that part, and a lot of people in the theater were audibly
amused,
talking about
and
it.
Uncomfortable. Okay.
Yes.
Did you actually see it in a theater with a lot of people? Were there other people in the theater?
Considering capacity limits, yes, it was a lot of people.
Well, I'm glad to hear that people are, when they can take an opportunity to get to the theater, they do. So hopefully they were being careful about it when they're in the theater. I've gone several times in the last couple of months, and I would say 90% of the time I'm the only person in the theater.
That was my experience too.
And I don't mind seeing a movie alone. I don't know how a theater is going to continue to operate if they get six people a day.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be able to stay open very long. But we'll save that for the rants and raves later on. The other thing that I had a little bit of a problem with is the coda at the end, where you get the usual trope of the unkillable killer coming back into the story, and it didn't really make any sense to me whatsoever. My daughter explained a little bit about how it was supposed to be probable that there's, because of the disconnected monitor in the ambulance, and so there, we really are being fooled into thinking something bad's happened to the Blissfield butcher. The fact that he was shot six times, I think, would be enough to make it, you know, something bad. This is not Freddy Krueger. This is not Jason Voorhees. Although they are based on these kinds of stories, this is supposed to be set where this is a human being, and
mm-hmm.
you know, killing people, getting out of the ambulance, coming back across, and then acting as if there was no body injury at all in doing that. They either need to have an explanation of that, you know, maybe they could have done something earlier in the film where until the transfer is complete after the 24 hours, neither of them can be really hurt. You know, they can't hurt each other. Maybe that would have been a way to explain it. But as it was, it just seems so improbable. And then I know the whole reason that that last section exists is to follow up on this empowerment theme that they have, which, by the way, I think is a little contradictory, because at one point it's empowering to be strong and to take vengeance on the guys that were bullying you when you are a 6'5" person now. On the other hand, you become the bully in your other form, doing the same thing, and then we get this, you know, payoff that comes at the end that I really felt was a little bit of a stretch. I understand why it exists there. I think it's satisfying watching it, and I like the lines, but it doesn't really feel like it's organic with everything else that's happened in the movie.
I agree with you on that. I saw it twofold. I explained it away in my head because, like you, I was like, okay, this movie should be done now. Like, you don't need this extra part. But I saw it as a callback to what Booker said to Millie when she was talking about how weak she is, and he says, you know, strength isn't physical, it's in here, and it's in here, whatever that moment was. But then I also saw it as a callback to the Halloween 2018, when you had three generations of Strodes taking down Michael Myers in that home. And I saw this as, oh, okay, that's what we're doing. I see you, Blumhouse. I gotcha. It just seemed like the three women taking down the drudging killer. It just seemed like a callback to that scene for me.
Yeah, I can see that. And I like the idea of that. Like I said, it just felt so ham-fisted trying to get it in there.
Agreed.
All right, well, does anybody have any other comments about the film, one way or the other, before we give our lamb scores?
Was anybody caught? I'd like to ask if anybody was caught by the gotcha of the watch. Did anybody not see that coming? Was it just me who thought that was really obvious?
Oh, that was pretty obvious, yes.
Okay, good. Like I said, again, I am not their target audience with this movie. I see this as a movie for, you know, PG-13 who are going into their first horror movies, and they might be surprised by that. I wasn't sure.
Well, yeah, when you get that scene in the shop class where Booker's telling her, oh, I set my watch 5 minutes ahead, you know, so that way I'm never late, I'm going, yeah, that's going to mean something later on. I mean, I knew that was coming up, because otherwise, why would you do that? They set the scene up for...
That's Chekhov's Apple Watch.
Yeah. And, you know...
English teacher says.
I'm okay with that. I mean, I know that those kinds of things need to happen, and you want to create a little bit of, you know, surprise for the moment, but I don't think anybody's going to be surprised at the end when mm-hmm. you know, there's the extra time. I just don't think that that's a surprise at that point, because we're all used to those sorts of things.
Right.
All right. Well, then let's give our lamb scores out of 5. Lisa, what did you think?
For what it is, I'm going to give it 3 lambs out of 5. I don't put it up against some of the higher quality, you know, classics of American film or any film. But for what it is, as far as it being, you know, a teenage slasher horror comedy, it does have some smarts to it. So I'm going to go 3 out of 5 because I did enjoy it.
All right. And Cameron, how about you?
I'll go 4.5.
Oh, you really liked it.
Yep.
You'll be seeing it again. You've already seen it twice, I can tell. This is going to be a video screening at home.
Yeah, maybe so.
Getting the Blu-ray.
There you are. There you are. Paul, how about you?
I'm giving it 4 out of 5 because I thought the tone was great. I thought the balance of horror and camp and comedy was great. And I can see this, you know, anything for Blumhouse, their content really rides the line of, like, being horrible to being really smart and clever, and I think that this is one of their better ones. And I'm excited to add it to my collection, too, because I do a what I call Scarathon Marathon every Halloween, where I have friends come over and we do, like, 3 or 4 movies. And this would be one where we would play at the beginning because it's not overly scary. My friends would enjoy the comedy out of it. So, yeah.
Good
deal. I'm curious to see if they do a sequel. You know, Blumhouse loves to do sequels. So if they try to figure out how to make it work, I think that'll be interesting.
Do you think they could do a sequel?
They better call it
Freakier. Freakier, yes. Yeah. Do you think they could do a sequel without Vince Vaughn?
I don't know. I feel like if they had someone else, then it would just seem like the repetitive nature of the same movie again, just with a different actor or character. I don't know. This is where I can't figure out how they would do it and not just feel like they're ripping off the whole thing all over again.
Well, somebody will figure it out, and they probably will rip it off all over again.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
All right, Amanda, how about you?
I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5 with the potential for it to grow to a 4 with future viewings. I enjoyed it. I don't think it's perfect, but there were a lot of things that I really liked about it, and I do see it kind of entering our annual sort of schedule during the Halloween season. But yeah, I quite liked it, but I didn't love it as much as I wanted to love it.
Yeah, and I'm pretty much the same way. I wanted to like it so much more. I liked a lot of things about it, but not everything, and there were a couple things that I found a little annoying. So I'm going to give it a 3.5, you know, 3.5, because I do think it has the potential for repeatability, and I could probably look at it a little more objectively, seeing it after knowing how everything plays out. Maybe I'll see some merits to it that I didn't see before, but I was entertained, and I'm just, like a lot of people, I'm happy to be seeing something in a theater that's new that you can't see online. You know,
Seconded.
You know, streaming is great, but the theatrical experience, I think, needs to survive, and if we don't enjoy the experiences when we get them, it's going to be a problem. Well, thank you all. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back after a few words from the following LAMB Podcasting Network show.
I was having serious problems in the bedroom, and in the car, and on the bus. But I couldn't help but think there had to be something out there for people suffering just like me.
Podcast dysfunction affects 6 out of 7 cinema geeks out there, but there is help. the Simplistic Reviews Podcast.
Symptoms of the Simplistic Reviews Podcast may include loss of sleep, loss of hair, longer erections, lost family get-together, bleeding of eyes, ears, and anus, divorce, hated by town folk, rash, the ability to drink alcohol and podcast at the same time, mansplaining, weight gain, weight loss, people with severe podcasting games, depression, happiness, growth of boobs and hair on chest, constant peeing, watery eyes, and 3 additional inches on your penis, and if you don't have a penis, you will now.
Thanks to the Simplistic Reviews Podcast, I'm no longer bored in the bedroom. Plus, I have a perpetual erection. Although I think I'm going blind.
The Simplistic Reviews Podcast. A small price to pay for entertainment.
I don't know what we're yelling about!
And we're back, everybody, and it's time for some rants, raves, and reviews this week. Lisa, let's start with you. What have you got to rant, rave, or review?
Well, if you'll indulge me a little bit, I just would like to rave briefly about the fact that I have returned back to my beloved recliner in the back left corner of the theater, my beloved G10. It was just so nice to get back to the theater. I haven't been to the theater since I saw Invisible Man back in February. And so just the opportunity to do this was just amazing. I mean, before all of this hit, I went every Friday after school. I left school, went straight to the theater, and saw a movie every week. So it was delightful to go back. My review would be for a movie I saw this week called Megan Is Missing. And this is a found footage horror film that a friend of mine brought up. It's one of those movies that's sort of been on my radar, but you could never quite get your hands on it. And I believe it's 2011, but it's set back in like 2007, which makes it sound like that's, you know, decades and decades back, but it's not. This is a strange one. So you can get it on Prime for $2. Nice, reasonable rental if you're looking for something random to watch. And it's about these 14-year-old girls, two very good friends, Amy and Megan. And they're, you know, one of them is more popular than the other, dealing with parent issues. One of them is more timid. One of them is more of a boisterous teenager trying to rebel against her mother that she has conflict with. And what ends up happening is Megan connects with this guy, Josh, over the internet. It's actually, now that I think about it, I think it's set more back in like 97. Wherever it is, it's back. Because we have a catfishing situation, as I can expect you would predict. But it's an odd film. I don't quite know what to do with it because the first three quarters of it, the acting really isn't good, to the point that you wonder, like, what kind of direction was anybody given? Because it seems pretty basic to me, the sorts of interactions. We do have the standard, these actors seem older than the characters they're playing, but, you know, we can get by that. There's a party scene, which is about as awkward as it gets. And then it takes a really, really harsh turn. Where you start seeing what it is this depraved individual has done to this girl. And I won't go into spoilers, but I will compare it to Dee Snider's Strangeland, which came out in the late 90s and was really a fantastic film about the dangers of teenagers talking on the internet to someone they don't know who it actually is. That one was 98, I think. It came out when I was still working at Blockbuster. And that one was really, really unnerving and scary because you have this person who is trapping young, impressionable girls who don't understand that the internet is not a safe place. And that one got really intense. And so it's what made me think of when I was watching Megan Is Missing. But give it a review, I'm going to say 2 out of 5. Because right. It's not something that I would say rush out and see this. But if you do like found footage and you're interested because it's one of those things that you've heard about for years and just couldn't get your hands on, it is available for a $2 rental on Prime.
All right. Well, Prime appreciates your endorsement. Amanda, what are you ranting, raving, or reviewing about this week?
I am going to do a quick review of a movie I watched the other night that I don't know why I hadn't seen it when it came out, but In Bruges, this is very much the kind of film that I like. It is a little bit comedy, a little bit, actually a lot bit sad, but it's Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson, and it's about two hitmen that are hiding out in Bruges. And I'm sure a lot of people know about it, but I had, like I said, I hadn't seen it, and I got the opportunity to watch it the other night, and I just really enjoyed it. I'm a pretty big Colin Farrell fan, although it's kind of funny. I was looking at his IMDb credits after watching the movie and realized I hadn't seen that many things with him or that he'd been in, but I just always like him in whatever he's in. And, you know, if anybody hadn't seen it, I don't want to spoil anything. So there's basically they're hitmen hiding out after a job has gone wrong, and the reveal of what goes wrong is pretty horrifying and impactful, and I just really enjoyed it. I laughed quite a bit. I was quite depressed at the end, so I thought that it was kind of an interesting balance of emotions, and I'm just glad that I finally got the opportunity to see it. And I guess if I was giving it a rating, I give it a 4 out of 5 just because I haven't had the opportunity to see it more than once, and so giving it 5 out of 5 would probably be a little bit premature, but definitely 4 out of 5. I, like I said, I quite enjoyed it.
Well, I'm glad you finally caught up with it. I remember struggling trying to get somebody to watch this with me 10 years ago, and nobody in the house was interested in seeing it with me, and I ended up watching it by myself after I think everybody had gone to bed. I enjoyed the hell out of it, and I'm glad that you enjoyed it as well. Good deal.
So actually, I have a memory of us watching. I had seen the first, 30 minutes of it. I think it was one of those things where it was on satellite, and we started to watch it, and we were going out somewhere. And so I definitely had seen part of it. I was interested in it, but for whatever reason, I had never come back to it. So.
Well, now we can come back to it again.
Yeah.
Cameron, how about you? What have you got for us this week?
Well, my question is, can I do a bit of a personal film-related rave?
Of course you can.
All right, well, yesterday I completed production on the first short film I've ever directed.
Nice. Hey, congratulations.
That's definitely something to rave about.
Yes, I will definitely share the link with you all once it is done editing, when I'm done with editing and all that.
So what's the – can you give us a hint about the subject matter, or would that be revealing too much? I don't want to, you know
– I feel like that would be revealing too much.
Okay.
Let's just say it's a conversation between two people that reveals stuff from the past.
Ah, very nice. And do you appear in the film yourself?
No, I do not.
Okay. Just checking, you know, because that does happen. Sometimes that's the way people get into this. They want to make a movie, and they need somebody, and the person that's most readily available to them is the one they see in the mirror. But when you have it ready to show to people, make sure that you send us a link.
Definitely.
Paul, first time, what have you got to rant, rave, or review about?
I'll do a quick rant and a quick rave. I can do a quick review, too. My rant is going to be all of the early award season Oscar nomination takes on Twitter that I feel like is starting so incredibly early. And maybe it wouldn't feel early if the Oscars and the Golden Globes were on a regular time frame, but knowing that the Oscar nominations won't even be announced until March 15th and the Golden Globes aren't announced until February 2nd, it just seems too early to, think of who, these are going to be the 5 nominations when so much changes between now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And even the week going into when the voting happens, it's all about what's kind of in the zeitgeist then. I mean, if you remember even last year, Parasite only had the momentum within the last, couple weeks going into the Oscars, which shows how much changes. So seeing all this, already makes award season annoying when it's this early, in my opinion.
Seconded.
Oh, I think we'll all agree with that one.
And then my rave is knowing that the Criterion Collection Barnes & Noble sale is going on right now, 50% off all their titles. I stock up like crazy anytime we get a Criterion Flash sale or a Barnes & Noble sale. So I bought a couple of Kurosawa movies the other day, a couple of Coppola movies, the first time I ordered. So I just always love, and they've got some fantastic box sets. So, like, now is the time to buy the Ingmar Bergman box set or the Godzilla box set, the Bruce Lee box set. Get them now. We can get them so cheap.
Excellent.
I know where I'm going after this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it when they've got that 50% off sale because, the prices are a little steep to begin with, but, boy, when it's 50% off, you say, now I feel – they know how to get you. You know, you feel like you're getting a deal, even though you're probably paying still more than they are, need to be able to break even. It's a little tough, though, and I'm happy to keep physical media alive. I love that. Very nice. Very nice. Well, this week I've been a broken record for a couple of months now, and I'm going to squawk one more time about things. I want everybody to see Wonder Woman. I'm happy that they get a chance to do that. I just hate the fact that they're going to be streaming it at the same time they're releasing it in theaters. I'm telling people, and I've said it before, they're committing assisted suicide here. They need to put product in theaters or else people aren't going to go back. Now, obviously, some places are still closed down. That's a problem. Sounds like Michigan's closed down again after being briefly reopened. That's a problem. But a lot of places, the theaters are open, and the only product they have is they're showing, Toy Story or The Empire Strikes Back, which are great to see in a theater. I have no problem with that. I love those films and glad to see them in a theater. But that's not going to bring in enough people to keep the theaters going. People are going to say, well, I've seen Toy Story 50 times since my kids were little. I'm not sure I need to go to the theater to see it. Cinemaphiles might do that, but the cinemaphiles aren't going to be able to keep all the AMCs and Regals and Lemleys and other chains going. They've got to have some product out there. And if Wonder Woman is streaming the same time it's playing in theaters, I imagine a lot of people are going to choose that option instead. And they're creating a bad habit for people. And I just worry. It's a terrible dilemma to be in, but it frustrates me. And I wish it wasn't that way. But that's, if wishes were fishes, we'd all be having mackerel for lunch.
I love that phrase, but I'm with you. I agree.
Well, I think if Warner Brothers would have moved it early on, it would have been – they could have done it in 2021. But I think the 2021 calendar right now is so full, I wonder if they really had a hard time finding the right weekend to throw it in.
They've moved it twice. I think they thought, if we move it again after we said we were going to do it on Christmas, that's – not going to look good for them, and I appreciate that they are still doing a theatrical release. It's just the streaming on the same day that just seems to me like a recipe for disaster down the road, that people are going to start expecting that instead of going to the movies, and I hate that idea.
What's the price going to be, do we know?
If you are a subscriber to, what is it, HBO Max?
What's
it
going to be?
It's just going to be released on Max? I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
So if you, and that's, of course, what HBO Max wants. They want a whole bunch of people who want to see this movie to start streaming their service. And that makes sense to them. The problem is it makes sense to them, but it doesn't make sense to all those theaters. They've let this window narrow more and more over the years to the point where it doesn't exist anymore. And theatrical windows, if they don't exist, people just be, they've got a rationale for themselves to stay home. And I still think people want to go out and do things, but, individually, I want them to go out and do things too. I want to be part of society. I don't want to just live at home. And I know that that's the world that we're in at the moment, but we don't want to make this too much of a habit. Anyway, that I'm a broken record because I've said this before.
If I'm correct, the first month that Wonder Woman 1984 comes out, it'll be theaters and streaming. The second month is going to be strictly theaters.
So it'll only be available for a month.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Streaming. Do we know if it's
going to be available to people who are doing a free trial on HBO Max? Because
that's a good point.
Yeah, I would imagine everybody would just say, oh, I'll just do the 7-day free trial and then cancel and see it, and unless there's some sort of stipulation about that.
The reasoning I'm hearing as to why they did it, theaters and streaming the first month and then fully theatrical the second month, is because apparently they think that the vaccine will be out by then and a lot of people will be vaccinated.
Well, let's hope that things, you know, we all want that to clear up. And, you know, it would be great if we returned to normalcy. I just don't think it's going to happen that quickly.
I agree. I don't think so either. Because I can't see people jumping at a vaccine that we don't know what the effects are, really.
Yeah, I think, well, it's going to take a while for it to roll out, for people to feel confident in it. And we still have to see some of those places open up that have been unwilling to open up. I've only been in the Austin area for 3 months now. I came from Southern California, and they are locked down tight there. Nobody is going anywhere to do most things. All the restaurants that were open, I think they've been mostly closed down now again, and the theaters never opened. So it's just, somebody's going to have a lot more confidence, and it's tough for the studios because, you know, they spent a lot of money. That's why like I said at the top of the show, I think Freaky had the advantage. It's not a lot of budgetary investment that they made. There are enough people going that they can get some money back at this time. It's just tough when you got a movie that you spent $200 million making and hoping that you're going to get some money back in the theatrical release, and that's not going to happen. I don't know what the financial deal with HBO Max is for Wonder Woman. I'm sure.
Yeah, my goodness.
Well, I think HBO Max.
The DC movies on there. I think I think HBO Max has some sort of contract with Warner Brothers because
they do
those movies.
Yeah, Warner Brothers. They were going to do a streaming service and they decided to do basically HBO Max. So it's like all of the Warner Brothers content that can be streamed is going to be on HBO.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although they have their various partnerships. They're with Studio Ghibli and Jim Henson and TCM. They've got a number of different exclusives on their service.
It's a great service.
I was going to say, I had an interesting thought. I do think it's interesting that in California, the theaters are all closed, yet entertainment workers have been deemed essential. So it's just kind of funny that, like, they're still making movies and they're still making TV shows and things, but people can't actually go to the theater to see things. And that's just a kind of an interesting situation.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, let's play a game. I've got a brief game here that I just stole it. It's not something that's original, although I did think of the idea a little bit, but I knew that it had existed in other places. The movie that we saw today is a mashup of movies. There have been movie mashups before. This is the movie title mashup game. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the description of a movie that is a mashup between two other movies. And those movies will have a word or phrase in common. And what you need to do is you need to give me the title of the movie that is the combination of them. So, for example, a hotel maid princess makes a bargain with an unscrupulous sea hag who changes the princess's clothes so she can fall in love with a human senatorial candidate on the land. And that would be... The Little Mermaid in Manhattan. Right. So we've got a few of these. I figure you just use your name as a buzzer when you can come up with an answer. First one to three wins, and if I run out of them, whoever is leading at the time wins and gets to plug first. All right? Has everybody got it?
Yep.
Okay. A young Greek woman falls in love with the groom in a wedding that she's directing, and the whole family must accept him while she comes to terms with her heritage. The wedding that she is directing.
My Big Fat Paul.
Paul.
Is it my Big Fat Greek Wedding Planner?
It is, Paul. There you go. A snobbish phonics professor agrees to a wager that he can take a flower girl's innocent pet cocker spaniel and make her presentable in high society before a streetwise, downtrodden mutt falls in love with her first.
Lisa.
Lisa.
Is this My Fair Lady and the Tramp?
It is. Two high school friends who can hardly spell get caught in the middle of a mafia deal while babysitting, so they struggle to prepare a historical presentation with the help of a time machine while getting out of the big city and back home.
Cameron.
Cameron.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures in Babysitting?
That's it, Cameron. Against his own expectations and the scorn of his friends, an aimless high school African-American football coach finds himself falling in love with an outwardly plain girl who possesses a passion for life and racially integrated football teams he never imagined possible. And with her help, they win the season before she dies of cancer.
Amanda.
Cameron.
Amanda.
A Walk to Remember the Titans?
There we go. Everybody's gotten at least one now. All right. A ticket-collecting romantic pretends to be estranged to an unconscious... pretends to be engaged to an unconscious man whose son calls a radio show in an attempt to find his father a partner. Well, the ticket collector really can't... Lisa.
This one changes the word format a little bit. While you were sleepless in Seattle? Like, yes. While you were sleeping? Okay.
Yes. Yeah, well, it does mash them up a little bit, but Lisa, you right. Definitely get a point for that one.
Sorry, the English teacher got caught up on the word forms.
Believe me, I have a couple of these that I feel exactly the same way about, and I may not use them. The Soviet Union's best submarine captain in his newest submarine violates orders and heads for the U.S., while a coal miner's son with an interest in rocketry, Paul.
The Hunt for Red October Sky.
There you go, Paul. A listless, alienated teenager decides to coach a peewee hockey team as well as help his new friend win the class presidency while gaining and teaching respect in their small Western high school.
I need that again, please.
A listless and alienated teenager decides to coach a peewee hockey team as well as help his new friend win the class presidency while gaining and teaching respect in their small Western high school. Lisa, this is another one of those ones that the English teacher might be fussy about.
Yeah. I've got one of them. I'm trying to find the other one.
Because two words get mashed together.
Lisa got it.
Lisa.
Napoleon Dynamite Ducks.
That's it.
Jeez, you're killing me, Richard.
Well, you were the first one to three, so you win. You get to plug first. Okay. What have you got, Lisa, to plug?
So I will just plug the Critical Critics website, which can be found at thecriticalcritics.com. I am one of their critics there, but because of the school year and because of the chaos of trying to balance in-person learning with distance learning, I am not quite as active as I might have been in the past. However, there are many other critical critics who are exceptional, and you should definitely be reading and sharing their reviews, please.
And Paul is our guest. Let's have you not our guest. You're all my guests. But as our newest guest, let's have you go next.
You can go to my website or YouTube channel. It's Paul's Trip to the Movies. I've got a ton of movie reviews and some TV streaming reviews, and I've been doing a ton of interviews lately. So coming up, I'll have interviews with Melissa McCarthy, Bobby Cannavale, Judy Greer, Lois Smith, Rachel Brosnahan, and then more coming down the pipe.
I'm already subscribing to your YouTube channel.
Thank
Looking forward
I'm
to
close
it.
To 500. I'm close to 500.
Good deal.
Very cool.
Thank you.
Cameron, I know your film isn't ready yet. Do you have something else that you can plug?
No.
Okay. You are starting your blog again, right? Didn't I hear you say that earlier?
No, actually, no, not for a while. I have to renew the domain on it, and I can't do that at the moment.
All right. So nothing new until the film comes out. We got it.
Exactly.
Amanda, what have you got to plug?
Well, it's not really movie-related, but I finally put up another video on Hollywood Consumer. It's just I've been doing some book subscription box unboxings, and this was one that was about a new release from my favorite author. Actually, it is kind of movie-slash-TV-related because the book is being adapted into a TV show, so there you go. That's how I got it connected, but that's up on Hollywood Consumer.
You want to tell us what the book is?
Yes, please. It's The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue by V.E. Schwab.
Oh, that book is supposed to be spectacular. I just haven't got my hands on it yet.
It is. I may have gotten a couple of copies of it. It is.
Wait, say now.
Understatement.
It is wonderfully written. V.E. Schwab's my favorite author, so I'm a little bit biased, but she's very poetic in her writing. So, it was quite good. But it's nice. Like I said, it's being adapted into a TV show. There was a book box that was all about it, so I decided to do an unboxing.
Who did the book box, if you don't mind me asking?
Owl Crate.
Oh, cool. All right.
Yeah.
And Owl Crate gets a plug on the Lambcast, which is fine, perfectly fine. On my site, I'll have a review up by the time this gets posted for a movie I saw on Friday, The Last Vermeer, which stars Guy Pearce, and I thought was pretty successful. It's an interesting story about artwork at the end of World War II, and it was a story that I didn't know anything about, and it's based on real events. So I know that they did some dramatic license on it. They always do those kinds of things. But the actual story, there are real characters, real things happened here, and anybody who's not familiar with it, I think you'll enjoy it. I can't wait to get the book because I'm going to read all about this. History is one of those things that I really enjoy reading about, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And here on The Lamb, we do have an announcement. The movie of the month for next month has been decided, and the vote was overwhelming. I don't think anybody else came close, with nearly 30% of the vote out of the 10 movies that were nominated. Amanda, congratulations. Arthur Christmas is the movie of the month next month.
Oh, congratulations.
So you will be hosting the movie of the month discussion next week, which means you get to put together the game.
Wait a minute. It's next week?
Next month. It's still a couple of weeks away. I think it's 3 weeks away. I'll have to double-check the schedule.
Oh, that means I get to watch Arthur Christmas. Not
yes.
That I'm going to anyway.
So that'll be a lot of fun, and that's about it for today's show. I would like to thank all of our guests for being with us today. Cameron, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're Amanda, welcome. I appreciate your showing up.
Thanks for having me.
Paul, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Take care, everybody.
Listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Oh,